Leonardo da Vinci was a certifiable genius, but historical evidence suggests that he was also something of a late bloomer. Mike Lankford uses historical evidence and a lot of imagination to bring Leonardo to life. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Leonardo started his life as the illegitimate son of a rural Italian notary. He struggled to learn to write and was on his own from the age of 15. But somehow, this awkward boy became a master and a legend. Mike Lankford takes what we know about this man who lived 500 years ago and fills in the gaps with his own ideas. I'll talk with him about his book, Becoming Leonardo, An Exploded View of the Life of Leonardo da Vinci. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We all know something about Leonardo da Vinci. He painted the Mona Lisa and the Last Supper. He drew sketches of flying machines and had ideas that were well ahead of his time. But we know very little about the man himself. Mike Lankford has taken what we do know from the historical record and attempted to recreate Leonardo da Vinci, the man. His book is Becoming Leonardo, An Exploded View of the Life of Leonardo da Vinci. It is now out in paperback. Mike Lankford is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He lives in Bend, Oregon. He'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tonight at 5:30, and he is here with me now. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for asking me.
I'm curious about your personal interest in Leonardo da Vinci. Where did this start for you?
Well, I've had a lifelong habit. When I was 20 years old, actually, I moved to the country to an abandoned farmhouse. This is in southern Oklahoma. And I'd bought the great books of the Western world with the intention of reading all 54 volumes. But half of them, of course, are like Galileo's Dialogue of the Planets or something. But half of them were literature and philosophy. And I began reading my way through the great books and slowly acquiring, I thought, some degree of wisdom until I hit Leo Tolstoy and read War and Peace. And it was the most astonishing thing I'd ever run into. So I started just reading Tolstoy. And for the next 3 years, I lived and breathed Tolstoy until I had a sense of what the man was like, what it would be like to know him, what he was trying to say. And then finally, I'd exhausted the subject, and then I moved on to something else. I moved on to Van Gogh and another couple of years up the chimney, and then Herman Melville. And it's been like that my entire life. What happened with Leonardo was I generally avoided the Italian Renaissance because it's such a complex subject. But I saw a small, interesting book in my local indie bookstore out in Bend, and I bought it. And it was about Leonardo's scientific work, and yet the writer was claiming essentially that Leonardo had invented the modern world. And from every little invention he made, there was a computer or an airplane eventually to come from it. And it just seemed to me silly. It conflated the historical process. So I had more questions at the end than at the beginning. So I read the book again, marked it up, even more questions. I bought another book. Eventually, I'd read 20, maybe 30 biographies at that point, and I was overwhelmed with questions. So actually, the book started on its own. I did not intend to write this book, but I woke up one morning, and I was on page 3, just going at it like a beaver. And eventually, I had to get organized, developed a timeline and everything, but the book really generated itself.
Well, and it's interesting, the portrait of a man that you've created, you are trying to recreate this man who was born in 1452, and you've gone through all of these biographies, so you know what's left of the historical record, what we actually can concretely know about Leonardo da Vinci. How much is there?
Well, there are probably 2 dozen facts, what I'd call hard facts, and then there are maybe another couple dozen soft facts. Everything else after that is interpretation. And the analogy, I liken it to varnish on an old painting. It's been added and added over the centuries until we've reached a point where Leonardo is much obscured by all the intelligence that has been lent to the description of Leonardo's work. See, there's something you have to watch as a biographer that you don't reinterpret it in such a way as you alter it in some kind of way. And what I was trying to do was really strip off that the centuries of varnish and find a working human being. You see, when people describe Leonardo as a Superman, it must be great pleasure to do that. We enjoy admiring someone, but I think it alienates Leonardo from the aspiring artist who cannot find in themselves those superpowers. But Leonardo was a man, and Leonardo had more problems than abilities. He was, fairly assessed. He operated as an illiterate man in a very sophisticated social environment. He couldn't write so that someone else could read it. He couldn't read the knowledgeable texts of the time because they were in Greek or Latin. So he could only write backward, self-taught clearly, and read in his native Tuscan. And apparently he was profoundly dyslexic, so even how well he read was questionable.
Is a question. When we think about Leonardo da Vinci, anybody who thinks beyond, oh yeah, the Mona Lisa guy, give me an idea of what you think the image is, because I think it's largely drawn from the end of his life.
It is, very much. So Leonardo, we know, is the Leonardo of the last 20 years. Leonardo was an improvisational personality. He had gifts. He had an enormous problem-solving ability. His two greatest gifts, I think, were his remarkable instincts. He had intuition that was just astonishing, and longevity, because he was a very late bloomer, and most everything about Leonardo we know today was from the time of the Last Supper on, so late 40s.
Right, so an old man by Renaissance standards even then.
Yes, and what we have of Leonardo is so profoundly suggestive. All we have of Leonardo are scraps and pieces. But you look at those scraps, and one of them would be the Mona Lisa, which is an astonishment. And yet someone with that kind of talent did not paint all the time. He was an inveterate drawer. He drew the world. That's how he learned things, I think, was by analyzing visually. But he had problems writing. He did not have an editorial mind in many ways. He was probably ADD, I think, in many ways. A fascinating psychology, because I think he was very psychologically aware. If you look at the Mona Lisa as a philosophical painting, as a psychological painting, it is enormously complex. And I think one of the things that fascinated Leonardo was how you can put this next to that and a third thing appears. And he was forever puzzling over how this aesthetic sense worked. So he was an innovator largely because he was uneducated. He was not a jaded, sophisticated person who thought he knew the answer, but he was a relentless researcher. And every answer led to another question. So he just ran out of time eventually.
Well, let's go back to the very beginning, at least what we know of the very beginning. We know that he was born in 1452, and we know that he was illegitimate. His parents were not married. What do we know about? Well, let's start with his father, who we know a lot more about. But what do we know about his father?
Sir Piero was the son of an accountant attorney named Antonio. And Sir Piero was from the village of Vinci, which was about 30 miles from Florence. And he had left the homestead at that point to be a notary in Florence. And one of his clients who had died in 1451 owned a domestic slave. Now, domestic slavery was allowed in Florence because 100 years earlier you'd had the Black Death and the destruction of perhaps 80% of the Italian population. So they allowed the importation of domestic slaves and
from
North Africa and Turkey, mostly. And so the assumption, there are two or three theories around this, but what certainly makes the most sense to me is that this person who had hired Sir Piero as his executor handled his property, and he had a slave named Caterina, who the very next year shows up in Florence pregnant with no history. So the appearance is of probably rape.
I think about, of course, all of the atrocities that were committed in the name of slavery here in the United States, and so many children were conceived in that way, but not claimed by their fathers. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is a time not long after this terrible loss in Italy. Is that part of the environment that would lead a child that is illegitimate in this way to be claimed by his father?
His father was very negligent towards Leonardo. He left the boy with his grandparents.
Okay, but he was with his father's family.
Yes, but as an illegitimate son, he was not eligible to enter into the profession or even allowed a better education. He was given an abacus, what they call an abacus education, which was simple bookkeeping.
All right.
A mercantile education.
And we know that, so he grew up in the rural countryside in Italy. We don't know a lot about who cared for him or whether he got to have a relationship with his mother, although there's evidence that you uncovered that shows that he would have had a relationship with his mother. But he also has an uncle that seems to take a great deal of interest in him. Tell me about him.
Well, Francisco was 16 years old at the time Leonardo was born. His grandfather was 80. So it was really his uncle who raised him. And the uncle was a boy himself. Now, the people didn't live that long in the Renaissance. 39 was the average life expectancy. But he was raised very casually, I suspect. The evidence is that he was not taught to write. That he taught himself to write. Left-handedness was sinister at the time. A priest in the Middle Ages could not baptize a baby, for instance, if he was left-handed. Satan was left-handed. Judas, well-known left-hander. So Leonardo appears to have acquired things just on his own, like drawing. He didn't understand drawing, but he had this massive instinct for it. And likewise, he apparently taught himself to write because it would have otherwise been corrected.
Right. Well, he would have been taught to use his other hand, which you think he probably could never have been an artist like he was if he'd been trained to use his right hand.
One of the fascinating things is all the research that never makes it into the book. I researched people who were native left-handers who had been corrected.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a large Native American population that were that happened too.
And sure, a number of our listeners too.
Yes, and it's always regretted. There's a natural intuition. Toss a ball at a natural left-hander who has been trained to use their right, and they lose that millisecond, you know. So I think something. I mean, I'm a little. I grew up dyslexic, and so I've always filed my books right to left, simply because they're easier to find. But how you organize the world is a tremendous matter of organizing yourself, you know, and that was a difficulty for Leonardo.
We'll talk much more about that in just a moment. My guest is Mike Lankford. He is the author of Becoming Leonardo, An Exploded View of the Life of Leonardo da Vinci. It is now out in paperback, and he'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tonight at 5:30. We will continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Mike Lankford. He is the author of Becoming Leonardo, An Exploded View of the Life of Leonardo da Vinci. And he has taken the historical record, what we know about this man who lived 550 years ago, and he has tried to recreate the living Leonardo, the man that he truly was. The book is now out in paperback. He'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tonight at 5:30. And Mike, just before the break, we were talking about how Leonardo as a young man was largely uneducated, had a very informal education, and he developed this way of writing that was completely backwards mm-hmm. to most people's way of thinking. So he wrote right to left.
Yes.
And well, you can read his writing with a mirror.
Yes.
But there were efforts to try to teach him to write the other way. And you've seen text that it looked like he tried to write the other way as well?
He had a certain, what I call kindergarten, a pencil squeezing quality to his script. There were block letters and they were very awkward, but it's clearly in his hand. So the guess would be that his father probably, when he first brought Leonardo to Florence at age 15, which is rather late, he may have tried to make a clerk out of him. But even the fact that he came, he was left alone really until he was 15, which was very late for an apprenticeship at the time.
And so, he did find an apprenticeship when he moved to Florence. Tell me about the position that he found.
Well, the astonishing thing was there was one of the workshops in town was run by a man named Verrocchio, a Renaissance man on his own, and he was the teacher of Botticelli and several others. And the remarkable thing for Leonardo, I'm sure, growing up as he did, a unique kid in any environment, surely had never encountered anyone like himself until he entered Verrocchio's workshop, and then there was Botticelli sitting across the table and others. The big difference, I think, for Leonardo was that he had done these drawings, and they were remarkable drawings for an uneducated artist, but they were intuition. So what he learned from Verrocchio were the rules of perspective, the rules of shading, of color, and the language to talk about it. And I was reminded when I came to the workshop from Oklahoma, what I learned in the workshop were the techniques of narrative. I had a strong story sense, but what do you do with it if you don't understand point of view and the techniques of writing? And so that's what Leonardo was given. And I think because of that, always emphasized technique tremendously to his students. Because I think Leonardo had at 15 reached the point where native talent would no longer do it for him. So he appreciated those rules when he learned them.
Well, and we can see his work from this period. His work from this time has lasted. You can see some of his evolution, but just really extraordinary abilities even then.
Even the mechanical ability of drawing was astonishing. What happened in his late teens, up to about the time where he did his first portrait, Ginevra, is the development of a compositional ability. And one of the great distinctions, I think, between Leonardo and how we oftentimes think of an artist is that he apparently thought of himself primarily as a composer. And if he would paint, he was this marvelous painter, and he did magical things with oils, but he almost never painted the entire painting. He would do the face, maybe a hand, and then a student would fill in the background. So Leonardo very much viewed painting differently. I think my analogy really is with a lot of country and Western musicians. There are some who are primarily composers. There are a few who compose and perform, and then there's the great bulk of performers out there. And I think had Leonardo his way, he would have just composed pictures for others to draw.
And it's interesting to think about, you know, and again, I'm putting this in modern terms, which you do as well. But, you know, to think about this lonely kid who winds up in this workshop and is finally seen. His abilities are recognized. He finally gets to express himself. It feels to me like that should be the moment where he's really found his people and his niche in the world. But it's fascinating to me that he does not really define himself as a painter, although, of course, we remember him as a painter. He does not define himself as a painter, even at that point in his life.
Well, a couple of modern distinctions we make, we think in terms of career, and career is actually an 18th century French concept. We also think in terms of arts and sciences, and that distinction did not exist at the time. Everything was what they called natural philosophy. So Leonardo was very much a person at the right time and the right place. Had Leonardo been born 100 years later, a lot of those fundamental discoveries would have been made. He had a quality of mind that asked the big questions and had an intuition to ferret out those answers. But had it been earlier, even 50 years earlier, he would have not lived the same life for several reasons. Gutenberg had not invented the press. Cheap paper had not come into existence. Leonardo, the biggest gift in his life, surely, was affordable paper. and he bought it in stocks, and that's one of the ways you're able to trace his paintings or his drawings is by the paper stock.
And he always had a notebook handy.
Always. He made the books. He hung them off his belt. He didn't. I researched the Renaissance clothing, and one of the things I'd always assumed about Leonardo was he was a pocket man, because he's the kind of guy who would, you know, have little pockets all over the place. But pockets were not part of Renaissance dress, so he hung, you know, a little bag around his neck. He would hang a sample or a collection bag on his belt. He'd have a little dagger because the crime rate was 30 times what it is today. And he carried a small, a very small book, handmade for observations. And the experience of being Leonardo was to see things and to draw them. Many of the devices that historians have said, well, he invented this or he invented that, actually appear to be devices that he would see and be curious about, so he would draw them. He was an astonishing draftsman. He could draw very quickly. And then the action of his mind, and this is really my observation, but over decades, the action of his mind was to synthesize. You see that not only in the devices, where he would take one device that did a particular thing and a second device that did the next thing, combined them into one. So a sense of automation was there. But also he synthesized, I think, humanity in ways. I mean, if you look at his St. John in the Desert, for instance, it's a very effeminate character. So the sense is that there was a sort of a synthesized human model for him, an androgynous model that he saw as prototypically human. See, he was a divided person, and that's one of the reasons it lends credence to his mother being Turkish. It was a divided identity, and he worked by polar opposites, ugly, pretty, evil, good. These polarities seemed to drive him.
He also became a musician and developed that part of his art in a really somewhat unusual way.
Yes. And there's a big question about what he was doing in Milan the last several years of his life. Because he was not finishing his assignments, he left work when he left Milan. It's questionable about how he lived, but what we do know he was doing a lot of was playing music. So I researched what it meant to be a musician in Florence at that time. And it is very different from today. Basically, you live by passing the cup. You would perform, and then people would give you money. So it was a very precarious existence. And I think he was, you know, it's a big question. Why did he want to leave town? I mean, Cosimo de' Medici was there. His father was there. He was established there. And yet he wanted to get out of town for some reason. And I think probably the defining event was when Pope Sixtus had built a new chapel, the Sistine, and he wanted it decorated. So he wrote to de' Medici to send the best painters in Florence south to decorate his chapel. And de' Medici sent everyone except Leonardo. The question is why. The suspicion amongst a lot of historians is that Cosimo was homophobic. And so Leonardo's probably pronounced homosexuality was what partly ostracized him, I think.
Well, and there's evidence for that being a tremendous obstacle for him in his early life in Florence. He was actually arrested.
He was. And it was an anonymous accusation. Him and three friends were out partying one night with a young male prostitute, and someone had dropped a notice in effectively a public mailbox accusing him of sodomy. And he was arrested, and he was thrown into, you know, what we'd call a dungeon. How long he was there, we don't know. It may have been a few days or a few weeks. But then a second accusation came through. A second accusation should have led to punishment. But the person—
And it was a capital crime.
Yes. You could be burned at the stake for this. But the person who made the accusation did not come forward. They just kept making the accusation. So some way or another, Leonardo was eventually released. Now, that, too, is a fascinating thing, because you spend even 10 minutes in a dungeon and you make friends with, you know, all kinds of small critters. So surely it was a traumatic experience for him. And he says later, you have thrown me in prison. you know, he said that decades later, but the people he counted on were people he could not really count on. So he was a suspicious person, and was very much his own person. If there's a lesson from Leonardo, one of the lessons surely is to see with your own eyes. You know, people will tell you what to think, but you have to see with your own eyes to know.
I'm talking with Mike Lankford. He is the author of Becoming Leonardo, An Exploded View of the Life of Leonardo da Vinci. And before da Vinci leaves for Milan, which was a very important turning point in his life, in his career, if you want to call it that, he does make a connection. He has a young man who becomes his partner, his lifelong companion,
yes.
Really. What do we know about him?
Well, he's a fascinating person. If there was any lost document from the Renaissance I would love to hear has been discovered, would have been the personal journal of Zoroastro. I call him, I shorten it to Zorro in the book, but he hooked up with Leonardo in Florence. He was a painter. He probably... After this sodomy arrest, one of Leonardo's students was later removed from Leonardo's workshop because of the unhealthy atmosphere. And Zorro was probably the student that replaced him and became his paint maker, his model maker, his apprentice, and stayed with him for 30 years or more. Went to Milan, came back with him, went to Rome, and eventually stayed in Rome. Oh. Zorro was a necromancer, was an astrologer, was an alchemist. He was a total vegetarian, large black beard. He probably was closer to Leonardo than anyone else.
Was he a vegetarian before Leonardo became a vegetarian?
It's not sure.
Okay. He also... picks up another lifetime companion a little later on when he's in Milan. Tell me about this young man.
Well, Leonardo had was in Milan about 8 years, and he apparently was not being adopted by Ludovico Sforza as quickly as he had hoped. Giorgio Vasari tells the story that Leonardo was an instant hit, but the reality is that Leonardo was sort of a freelancer around the court for a long time. And then he finally got this equestrian project, which he spent 8 years on, never got the thing done. But during that time...
Make a giant horse out of bronze.
24-foot-high horse.
Right.
And during that time, his mother came up from Vinci, Caterina, to Milan to spend her last year or so with Leonardo. And then she died. And then the horse project was taken away from him. So Leonardo was very much adrift for a while. And then he some way or another, came into contact with this boy, 10-year-old boy, who he named Salai, which means little devil.
And that's the only name that we know this boy by.
No, he has a proper name.
Okay,
I don't remember. And it might even have been that Leonardo purchased the boy. It was that age. But he was 10 years old, and he came to live with Leonardo. And he stayed with him almost his entire life. But he was probably his lover and an apprentice and was a pretty good artist.
So let's talk about that trip to Milan. Leonardo decides that he needs to leave Florence. He wants to go to Milan, which is it's a dangerous journey to undertake at the time. And he wants to go to Milan to work for Ludovico.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about Ludovico.
Well, Ludovico was the second son. Ludovico was not supposed to be the duke, but power in the Renaissance was a matter of grabbing it when someone wasn't looking. So it was Ludovico's father who was the original usurper of the throne, and then he died, and his first son, Glazio, became the duke. Glazio was a bad character. He committed a lot of crimes. He would appropriate men's wives. He would,
torture the men.
Oh, if you raised a complaint, he'd cut your hands off. He was a terror. I say in the book that butterflies probably avoided him at
right.
all. But he was he generated tremendous resentment in town, and eventually was murdered by people. People he had offended. So his younger brother, well, his son actually, Gian, was seven, not old enough to assume the position. So his brother stepped in as regent. That was Ludovico.
Just being a helper.
Yes, just keeping things together. And Ludovico immediately made some changes, which actually benefited Milan. He started collecting an awful lot of taxes. The merchants didn't like it, but he was able to use it to make improvements around town and did fairly well. There were other engineers that worked for Ludovico, but eventually Leonardo was hired on a fairly permanent basis.
And we don't have time to read this epistle that he sends in advance, but he tries to sell himself to Ludovico in I think some really surprising ways. I mean, here he was an accomplished musician and an accomplished painter, but that is not how he tries to sell himself to Ludovico. What did he say he could do?
Well, as you pointed out, travel was a very difficult thing at the time. So simply to get to Milan required being part of an organized party. And so Cosimo was sending a delegation north to welcome the new Duke, Ludovico. And Leonardo got on as part of that gift package going north. And Leonardo made a life-size silver skull, which, when flipped over, you could strum it with a bow, and it was a violin. It doesn't exist, of course. But he went to Milan as a musician.
All right, and we'll pick this up in just a second. I'm talking to Mike Lankford. He is the author of Becoming Leonardo, An Exploded View of the Life of Leonardo da Vinci. The book is now out in paperback. He'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City this evening at 5:30. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, my guest is Mike Lankford. He is the author of Becoming Leonardo, An Exploded View of the Life of Leonardo da Vinci. It's a biography of Leonardo da Vinci, but he takes what we know about Leonardo, the historical record, and does a lot of imagining to fill out the personality of the man that is now the legend, Leonardo da Vinci. So just before the break, we were talking about when this is, again, we're very early in his life, when Leonardo decides to travel to Milan. He sells himself as a person who can do all sorts of extraordinary things that he's never done before, but he seems very certain that he could do. And one of them was to create war machines so that you could win any war. And I mean, the list is incredibly long. Do you think that, I mean, obviously he wanted a job, but do you think that he had a firm belief that he could accomplish all of these things?
I think so. He probably had access to some mechanical books or engineering books that he was able to study some of these things. He certainly had a sense that he could do them. But one of the things we think of as being uniquely Leonardo, these drawings surrounded by text, are actually he got from an earlier engineer whose text he probably studied. But it had always been his ambition to be an engineer, an ingenio. And I think part of the reason, it goes back to his dual identity, but an ingenio is very many many skills in a single person. And that suited Leonardo to a T.
Well, and you kind of paint a picture of him not as a court jester, but as the court entertainment. You point to a lot of his drawings that have survived, and you feel like these were drawn just for the pleasure of the Duke?
Well, it's one of those unexamined areas. You look at the notebooks, and the more you study them, you find these remarks that get forever quoted or requoted. And the assumption is that Leonardo is writing to himself some lesson to the world, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. He never published anything in his life, even the anatomies, which would have been so beneficial. They were always for him. So the function of the notebooks and what he meant when he wrote, he had this odd wooden kind of prose. He was not a writer, and he always addressed himself in the second person. So you must not take such long naps. And I read that not as most historians who say, don't take naps, be like Leonardo and work all the time. I read it more like a Ben Franklin diary, like an admonishment to the self, stop taking so many naps. Huh. You have to remember there were no stimulants. In the Renaissance, there was no electricity. Leonardo spent half
his... real medicine. They had to be exhausted all the time.
He spent half his life in the dark, and a candle was a powerful thing. You put a mirror behind it, you've doubled it, you know. So his life was so different from ours, and the pace of life was so different from ours, that was part of the enchantment for me is getting 500 years out of the 21st century and into an earlier age.
So we see this pattern when he's working for Ludovico that repeats frequently later in his life, this pattern of coming up with a giant vision and then never bringing it to fruition, which is not the kind of thing that we think about when we think about this great genius. But he spent years and years not building this giant horse.
Right. Preparing to build it. One of the odd things about Leonardo is we think of projects as being organized events. With Leonardo, a project was more an exploration. So he would lose himself in the research, apparently. And he had always an abundance of ideas. So even settling on a particular scheme was a difficulty for him. The plague of Leonardo's life was to always see possibilities in something. A friend in Oregon, after reading the book, told me that Leonardo was conceivably the worst employee in history.
I think that sounds fairly accurate. He did. Ludovico demanded that he create a painting for him. Ludovico was preparing his own tomb, and he wanted a masterpiece, and he wanted it painted on a wall because he didn't want anybody to steal it. And that is what became The Last Supper, which is a fascinating story in and of itself. And the fact that Leonardo was able to conceive it and take it to completion, but at the same time, he was undermining himself because he knew it couldn't last.
Yes, this is controversial. But what he was doing was mixing his paint. He came up with what he called oil tempera. Tempera paint is made with egg and color. And that's how it binds to the surface. Leonardo's should have painted a typical mural, which would have been one layer deep. You put on the fresh plaster and you paint it before it dries. He couldn't do that. He said it was not my art. In a letter he tore up, he'd written to Ludovico. But his effects were all with oil, and it required a depth of light to sort of release that inner glow. And he couldn't do that with using standard techniques. So he invented a new kind of pigment or a new kind of application, and he kept adding layers to it. Now, there's several important things about that Last Supper, but the most important thing is when we think of Leonardo, or when Giorgio Vasari describes Leonardo as a famous painter, it's important to remember that everything prior to that was small portraiture, expensive, locked up in somebody's castle. The Last Supper was the first public work he ever did, and he was 50 years old.
After the Last Supper, I mean, his reputation spreads. Mm-hmm. People know that he is a master painter, and people want him to paint things for them. He ends up leaving Ludovico, who's in dire straits at that point. Mm-hmm. And he goes to work for Caesar Borgia, the worst of the worst. And you speculate a little bit about that. And I'm really curious about this because your speculation leads you to think, well, only these monsters would employ Leonardo da Vinci. But I'm curious, I mean, what do you think attracted him to these monsters? I mean, he seemed to want that proximity to power because it strikes me that he could have had a decent living painting portraits for rich people.
He could have. I think he applied for work wherever he could find it. But I think the ones who hired him were those desperate enough to need him in some kind of way. So Ludovico Sforza and Cesare Borgia later both wanted something exceptional from their engineer. Borgia, because he was about to mount a campaign and carve out his own little fiefdom. His father was Alexander VI, Pope of Rome. So he had the papal army at his back. Caesar Borgia probably killed his brother, probably had sex with his sister, and was a psychopath with an army.
And Leonardo was right there with him when he was committing these incredible massacres, and his technology and ideas were being used to kill all of these people.
Yes.
So it seems like at the beginning of this, he's able to remove himself from this idea. He even writes in one of his notebooks something that we hear echoes of many times today, which is something like the knife doesn't kill people. It's the man who's holding the knife. And so that seems to be excusing him from responsibility. But then after just a horrible massacre, he seems to go through this incredible transformation. You mentioned earlier that he was a vegetarian. This is the point at which he becomes a vegetarian and a pacifist?
Mm-hmm. I believe so. I mean, his early exposure to war at the time was largely siege warfare. So you would starve people to death. And in his first exposure to war, it was under Ludovico, was to reroute a river from the city of Navarre, where he was attempting to ransom or force the French king into a ransom. And as a consequence, Ludovico sealed his own fate. But Leonardo took those skills with him to Caesar Borgia, and it put him in the middle of an ongoing atrocity. And apparently at some point, he had to withdraw, which is a highly unusual thing to do, from the battle. So the suspicion is that he was having some kind of psychological collapse. But the miracle of Leonardo was that once he was free of Borgia and back in Florence, he woke up. I mean, the artistic impulse came back, and he started sketching a woman who lived across the street from his father named Lisa. And he also got from his good friend Machiavelli a commission for the city council hall, which was another commission he could not complete, probably because of the post-traumatic stress disorder. But he apparently changed his life in a lot of ways, stopped cutting his hair. And
this is sort of the mystical Leonardo that we know.
Yeah.
And he also seemed to have, throughout his life, social interactions seemed to be difficult, in spite of the fact that he did have these two men who were with him always, his Zorro and his young man that...
Salai.
Right. Who was with him, you know, through the rest of their lives, really. But he seems to have a difficult time with social interactions with pretty much everyone else. And he seems to have a feud with Michelangelo.
Well, Michelangelo seemed to have a feud with him.
You're taking sides.
Yeah. Well, Leonardo was a generation older than Michelangelo, and Leonardo was a very solitary character. So when he was back in Florence and Machiavelli had gotten this commission for him to paint on the council wall this Battle of Algeari, which was a 200-year-old battle where Florence actually beat Milan in a fight. And he struggled with it, and he struggled with it, and I think his conflict was he found himself glorifying what he despised, warfare. But it was during that time that he just stalled out, and kept leaving the project. It was a complete mystery why. But Machiavelli was his great friend and probably paid the price, as many of his friends did who would go out on a limb for him. But Leonardo was self-involved in a way that is hard to understand sometimes.
I loved the story that you shared. He actually was involved in an effort to censor Michelangelo's David. Tell me about that, just briefly.
One of the rare events is that there's an actual transcription of a meeting between Leonardo and Michelangelo and these other artists. The city was trying to remove this statue from the front of the cathedral and replace it with Michelangelo's David. The question, they had pulled together the 30 leading artists in town, 29 of which showed up, to get their opinion on where to place it. And Leonardo
was... It was going to be up on a dome, but it was too beautiful for that. Mm-hmm. They needed to have it where people could see it.
Yes. Yeah, so the general agreement is it should go in front of the cathedral in the most prominent place. Leonardo took exception. He thought perhaps it would be better under the loggia over the side, out of the way, so as not to embarrass officials during public events, meaning, of course, the phallus. And so his suggestion was, and Michelangelo is in the room, his suggestion was that a little loincloth be designed. It added at least 3 months to the mounting of the statue, and Michelangelo, I'm sure, wanted to kill Leonardo at that point.
All right, we only have a few minutes left. Leonardo makes his way out of Florence again, and he's failed to create this large mural that he's been hired by the city to create. He spends years putting it off and not doing it. He leaves. And ends up leaving Italy, right? I mean, he takes his Mona Lisa, and that's about all he's got.
Well, he goes to Milan for a few years. We know nothing about what he did up there, but he's reputed to have done a complete anatomy of a horse. Spent years, an entire book on the horse. Half of his notebooks are lost.
Well, and he's spending a lot of time in hospitals and basements, yes, dissecting human bodies and animal bodies and creating these remarkable anatomies that never see the light of day until...
He had a number of beliefs, one of which is that all mammals reproduce the same way. So that famous fetus drawing you see, it's a human fetus in a cow's womb. He just interchanged parts like that. But he eventually ended up in Rome. The Pope would not allow him to do anatomies there. And eventually he went to France to live with the king.
And he leaves behind his most famous work, which was not famous in his lifetime.
No one had seen it. It was one of a half dozen paintings he carried with him, and he was still working on it 14 years after he started it.
Wow.
And again, I think that experience, if you think about the Mona Lisa, what you have is a painting that is full of inconsistencies. The left side of her face is different from the right, the top from the bottom. The background is high and low. So it draws the eye back and forth across the face from different directions, which creates this impression that she's watching you and changing impression. And I'm convinced that what Leonardo for 14 years kept evaluating is, how is it I put this next to that and I see a third thing? It was his neurology that he was fascinated with, but he didn't have psychology or any of those tools to work with.
And he wasn't trying to finish the painting.
No, he was trying to bring it to perfection, and he couldn't quite get there.
So this exercise that you've gone through in trying to bring this man to life and writing your book, what do you want people to take away from the Leonardo that you believe you know?
Well, I think a sense of self-integrity. Leonardo, for whatever reason, was a person full of a desire to understand himself and the world around him. He was born into chaos. And out of that chaos came a compelling need for order. And I think his entire life was spent trying to figure out how the world works so that he could understand himself. Those anatomies, psychiatrist friend of mine pointed out pretty early, he says, those anatomies are all on Leonardo. He wants to know himself. And so everything about Leonardo that he could research to inform himself was the passion of his life.
So you've taken a mystic genius and turned him into a man. Why is that important for us to think about?
I think it's terrifically important because to the young person aspiring to artistic quality, you look at Leonardo as an icon, as a model, and he's too forbidding. He's a Superman. No one can be that good again. But the reality, of course, was that he wasn't a Superman, and he has been turned into one over the centuries. So to make Leonardo accessible means that for the student who maybe writes in the wrong direction or is a late starter or something, it's a very human and doable ambition.
Mike, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Langford, he is the author of Becoming Leonardo, An Exploded View of the Life of Leonardo da Vinci. It is out in paperback, and he will be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City this evening at 5:30. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.